include links to that and as much other stuff as we touched on as possible in our show notes, which you can find if you're listening on a podcast, or you can go to our website at coachrange.org. And I guess I will just say, Jamie Dawson, thank you so much for joining me today. It was really a pleasure to talk with you, and good luck on passing this really, really important and valuable legislation.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show. You can find all of our shows and learn more about the mission and work of the Coast Range Association at coastrange.org, and make sure to follow our Facebook page. We're also on all the podcast apps at Coast Range Radio. We'd love it if you'd give us a review, and if you'd like the show, recommend us to your friends. If you have feedback or suggestions for future shows and guests, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you soon.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
This is Jacqueline Keeler, and this is American Standoff. And I've been on a little break for a couple of weeks. I've been working on finishing another book. This time about the standoff between the two different political sides of the United States, but about the Manhattan Project and how it impacted Native communities across the country and our Indigenous communities around the world. And so that's been sort of I've been on a deadline. So, and I've also been traveling. I was honored to be a finalist for the High Plains Book Award, and so I went out to Billings, Montana, and while I was there, I actually went to Yellowstone, and I had been really interested in going back to Yellowstone because I will share those reasons with you, because this is sort of an unusual episode where we're not just looking at the political standoff between far-right armed extremists storming capitals or that sort of thing. But we're looking at, I will return next week with a new, some updates. Of course, today the January 6th committee is having another televised hearing. The Proud Boys have been on trial. And so there's a lot to report in that regard. But today on American Standoff, we are looking at Indigenous Peoples Day, and I subtitle that Beauty Way, because I think when we're talking about this cultural standoff in America, we assume, and particularly many journalists assume when they're reporting on the issue, that that the culture is somehow okay, that this isn't the problem, the history of colonization, the very building blocks of what I like to call the origin story of the United States is not the problem. This is something, these extremists are coming out of left field, they're taking things the wrong way. But in fact, as you've heard me sort of go through episode by episode, this is not necessarily the case, that the colonial origin story has baked into it certain assumptions that do lead to these extremists, this form of extremism. And so Beauty Way, So I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation. My clan is Kia'ani. That's Towering House. My mother's Navajo. You know, her entire family are Navajo. And the beauty way comes from the Diné, the Navajo Diné tradition. And Diné is what we call ourselves, which means people. And so beauty way is the way of walking in beauty, of going through the world in a way that is in harmony. Beauty is linked to harmony in the Navajo language and cultural thought process. And so, you know, we often hear that term used, beauty, harmony, and what they call hojo in Diné, bizad. And so, you know, you say, you begin by praying, you know, hajo nasli, hajo nasli, hajo nasli, hajo nasli, you know, I walk in beauty. And you say that four times for the four directions. So, and when you talk about it, you talk about, you know, I'm walking in beauty, beauty before me, beauty behind me, beauty to the left of me, beauty to the right of me, beauty above me, beauty underneath. You know, everything is beautiful. You walk in that way. And Navajo language is the language that is sort of different than English, in that the descriptions of your world are not centered as you as the central point, and the rest of the world is sort of something you manipulate. And I think a common sort of example I give is like with, you know, if you're putting on your jeans, right, you're pulling your pants on, that is baked into the English language, is the assumption that you are the central point and the jeans are an object out in the world that you can manipulate, right? There's that built-in assumption into the very language itself, right? And that is not the case if you were to say it in Navajo. It's more like, I basically drift myself through the pants. You know, it's sort of like there's an assumption that you are the moving thing and the world around you has substance and reality. And so I think we often have to really look critically at our language, at our culture, at our political origin stories to really begin to understand the ways in which these may be backfiring, right, and creating the sort of cultural war that we're seeing now, which has actually become more than simply a war of cultural motifs, but actual armed they're arming themselves, you know. So as I said, you know, I went to Yellowstone and I was really, after I had written, I had been asked by Sierra Magazine to write about the nomination of Chuck Sams, a Umatilla tribal member from here in Oregon, to be head of the National Park Service. So I worked on the article, and as I worked, I was thinking about the national parks, and, you know, and ever since I wrote about the creation of the Bears Ears National Monument, I have often sort of spoken at conferences, public lands conferences, and met with a lot of amazing people out there, like amazing Americans out there who are doing the hard work of preserving these spaces, right, and for all of us. And so it's been a real honor to meet them, and I've learned, it's really deepened my appreciation for this land, for our mother. So I had found out doing genealogy that my it would be, I think the simplest way to describe it is my great great grandfather, his name was John Bordeaux. So his mother was the daughter of a chief, of a Lakota chief. He was from the Sitchanju Lakota band, and his name was Lone Dog. And his father was French Canadian. I think his name was James Bordeaux, or Jacques. I'm not sure, but Jacques or James Bordeaux. So his mother's father, his grandfather, was born in Yellowstone and around 1800. And so I was kind of shocked. I didn't really think about the Lakota people. Of course, they're farther west than my father's Yankton Sioux Dakota people are. But, you know, in our family tree, of course, we have members of all of the seven fires, council fires of the Ocheti Shakoin, the seven council fires of the Great Sioux Nation. And so even though we identify now in this generation as Yankton Sioux or Ihanktawan Dakota, you know, I have ancestors from pretty much every, all the seven council fires are in my tree, right? So I have Lakota ancestors as well as Dakota and what linguists call Nakota, which is Yankton. And so, yeah, so he is, so for the Yankton Sioux people, they were more in Minnesota and then where our reservation is now in South Central South Dakota, that is sort of our, the very far western parts of our traditional homelands. Although I do have ancestors that were born before the Americans came around where Standing Rock is now, so we ranged all over the place. So I was sort of surprised, because, you know, as a kid growing up and later as an adult bringing my own children to Yellowstone, I had never really thought about, you know, my own family having ties to that place. And so writing that article was sort of amazing to me, actually. And I will actually, so this episode is a bit different in that we're going to go through some of these things I've written. I know that maybe some of you don't get a chance to sit down and, you know, check out my muckrack journalistic portfolio and see what I've written and read them all. There's like over 50 articles on that, or so it's a lot to read. But I thought I would do that and see how it works, how it goes. So anyway, I think that, you know, this show will examine, we'll focus more on how Native American relationships with the land may unite us. And that has been a theme in my writing for quite a while, I would say, most explicitly in my article for The Nation in 2014 about how the land could make us one people. So it's been something I think about a lot. And even though I cover this division in our country today, I do, you know, my natural inclination is towards unity, some sort of accord, towards harmony, towards Hojong, right? And so, anyway, let's I thought we could open with some audio. We'll do a little bit of audio, not that much, with the story of Yellowstone many of you may be familiar with. So let me share here.
Yellowstone National Park. For many people, it is a wonderland filled with all the awe and power of nature. It is a pristine setting in the midst of the 21st century. Each year, more than 3 million people from around the world visit Yellowstone. They come to see the most famous geyser in the world. They come to see the wild animals in their natural habitat.
Okay, so that's a little intro there to kind of get you in your mind, kind of, you know, I don't know how many of you have been to Yellowstone. I imagine many have, obviously, if 3 million people a year are going there. I have to say, the last time I went there with my kids, it was pretty horrible. I mean, it was before the pandemic and the crowds were terrible. It was like a parking lot just driving in and trying to get places. And to be honest, we kind of just gave up and left because we were heading back to South Dakota to my dad's reservation. That's why my family has visited so much, because we, living in the Pacific Northwest, we drive through Montana and Wyoming to get to South Dakota to go home, for this, you know, to see family, to be on the res. So that's why I probably have been there more than most people. But I was pretty disappointed. But this time, you know, we went sort of at the end of the season and it was not that crowded, so it was very nice. If you have memories of Yellowstone or of any national park that has a great deal of meaning to you, please do call in. The number here in the studio is 503-931-8187. And I'd also like to do a land acknowledgement, which I often do at the beginning of the show, and introduce myself in Navajo. My name is Jacqueline Keeler, and My clan is Kia'ani Nishlis, and I am born for the Yankton Sioux people, the Hanktamon Dakota people. And I'd also like to acknowledge that what we now call Portland, Oregon, is located on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Cowlitz Band of Chinook, Tualatin, Kayapuya, Malala, and many other tribes. So then you had a little opening of the sort of the kind of Yellowstone that most people know about. And I touched a bit on my article that I wrote, and it actually was published in Sierra Magazine. It's titled, Can Indigenous Leadership Save Our National Parks and Monuments? And you can find it on the Sierra Magazine website. It was published almost exactly a year ago, October 11, 2021. I guess they probably did it for Indigenous Peoples Day. I sort of forgot about that. And it's subtitled, The Nomination of Chuck Sam Signals a New Path for Indigenous-Led and Managed Native Homelands. So, and there's a photograph that I had taken when we were in Yellowstone, and there's it's a buffalo that basically just stood in front of our car on the road. And so we had to sit there and wait for him to cross. And so I took a photo, and then they published that. And so so I will just begin by reading that. And if there are any callers while I'm reading it, you know, I will take those calls. And I think that we need to, the goal of this episode is to focus on our relationship to the land and what the land can teach us. And I'm doing that by exploring my own family's history and connection with the land, with our mother. So, here we go. My ancestor, Shunga Ishnala, Lone Dog, is said to have been born in Yellowstone in 1802 in the vicinity of what became designated 70 years later, Montana's Yellowstone National Park. His father, Wyoming or Montana, his father, Talapaha, Red War Bonnet with Sistan Dakota, but joined his wife, the Chandru Lakota Band, the Tisati Red Lodges, because their teepees were painted red at the top. According to my great aunt, Susan Bordeaux Bellyune, they dwelt between the Black Hills and the country lying around Laramie, where the buffalo ranged. I am descended from his daughter, Hunkalutawi, Red Cormorant Woman. Her father, Swift Bear, became chief. Most of Hunkalutawi's Lakota descendants, the Bordeaux family, now hail from the Rosebud Sioux Reservation in central South Dakota. My father's Dakota family descended from her son, John Bordeaux, and live on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in southeastern South Dakota. Her descendants live in tribal communities far from Wyoming, and the spectacle of one of Yellowstone's most famous attractions, Old Faithful, where throngs of tourists from all over the world gather to watch it go off like clockwork. We rarely think of ourselves as having a connection with that place. When I was there a few years ago, my family and I drove those roads, stopping to see Old Faithful and the artist's paint pots. At one point, we were stopped by a herd of buffalo crossing the road. As our little family stared at the buffalo and they stared back, calmly standing their ground, some on the asphalt, others in the timber on both sides of us, I was struck by how amazing it is that they and we are still here at all. The Americans had targeted Tatanka, this bison, for genocide as an act of total war against Native people. In 1868, General Sheridan wrote to General Sherman that they, quote, must make them poor by the destruction of their stock and then settle them on the lands allotted to them, unquote. In a few years, millions of bison were slaughtered for fun and profit by white hunters, their flesh left to rot in huge mounds. Their population plummeted from an estimated 30 million to a few hundred by the end of the 19th century. The cattle and Europeans that had arrived to replace us had each been bred and shaped for millennia by ancient systems of domestication and peonage. The term pioneer is derived from the French term for the disposable peons sent ahead of the regular army. That feudalism, dressed up in the language of freedom and progress and driven by the economic needs of colonialism and profit, could not abide genuinely independent beings like us. And by us, I mean my Dakota Lakota ancestor and the Tatanka. Our relationship with each other in the land was not built on peonage and domestication, but mutual respect. Even now, that organizing principle threatens the new order of extraction and exploitation. These old relationships we once held with the Tatanka Oyate, and they still do in our hearts, could help fight climate change. A large-scale prairie restoration project in Oklahoma uses a buffalo herd to help reestablish the ancient prairie grasslands, which contain more biodiversity than many rainforests. Perennial, these grasses can live up to 50 years of age and plumb the soil 15 feet deep, and they can also store carbon. The buffalo were brought in to graze a former cattle stockyard and have brought back the prairie through their natural grazing patterns. But pioneering lingers on in new ways. White ranchers are wary of the buffalo herd in Yellowstone and routinely call for its reduction through hunts and culling. They claim the buffalo carry a disease, brucellosis, that can harm their cattle. As a consequence, several thousand bison have been slaughtered since the 1980s from a herd that is comparatively small to their historical population. Wildlife advocates say the brucellosis argument has been thoroughly discredited. The National Park Service reports that the bison herd is increasing in size at a high rate of 10 to 17% per year, a rate that belies claims that brucellosis infection is causing fetal death. Under Montana state law, buffalo are designated as game, not wildlife, and the Yellowstone herd must be kept to 3,000, although advocates claim the park can maintain a herd four times that size. Typically, the National Park Service invites tribes to participate in the hunt, but does not consult them on whether this is the best management practice. Calls to add the Yellowstone bison to the endangered species list due to their unique genetic purity have so far gone unheeded. Last year, media reported hunters shot buffalo in plain sight with shocked tourists looking on. I greeted the news of Umatilla tribal leader Chuck Stamm's nomination to lead the National Park Service with both surprise and a certain amount of optimism. If confirmed, he'll be the first citizen of a federally recognized tribe to lead the NPS since this agency was created in 1916. Stamm is Cayuse and Walla Walla, two tribes that are part of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Southeast Washington and Northeast Oregon. He is also of Yankton Dakota descent on his father's side. His boss will be the Interior Secretary Deb Holland, the former representative from New Mexico and a Laguna Pueblo citizen. Holland was not only one of the first Native women to be elected to Congress in 2018, along with Ho-Chunk citizen Representative Charisse Davis, Democrat Kansas, but also the first Native American to lead the Department of the Interior, where she holds decision-making powers over vast areas of the United States and its waterways. The possibility of two Native people having such extensive oversight of our homeland is without precedent in American history. What could it mean for places like Yellowstone, for the bison that roam there, or for lands like Bears Ears repeatedly targeted for exploitation? Stamm will be taking the reins at a time when the National Park Service is struggling to adapt to a confluence of challenges, including chronic underfunding, the COVID-19 pandemic, climate change, and a national fight over public lands and the federal government's ownership of them. The far right demands that these lands be handed over to the state and even to counties for management and ownership. There have also been longstanding issues of equitable access to the parks, and NPS staff have been overwhelmingly white. Despite efforts to change that, there has been little movement. By 2018, lack of funding for the National Park Service had ballooned to $12 billion in deferred maintenance. Some wildlife advocacy organizations, include the Center for American Progress and the Center for Western Priorities, have questioned the $12 billion figure, noting that about half was for road building and maintenance that should be funded through transportation bills, not the Park Service. They allege the Trump administration was using the figure to promote the idea that parks and monuments are too expensive to be run by the public and should be privatized, a notion put forward by the conservative think tank Property and Environment Research Center, PERC. Ironically, a solution to the funding crisis came in the form of a bipartisan bill, the Great American Outdoors Act of 2020, signed into law by former President Trump, not known as a champion of the NPS after he reduced national monuments like Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. The law guarantees $900 million per year of royalties from offshore oil and gas drilling for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. The LWCF finances federal land acquisition and outdoor recreation grants for states. The act also created a new program, the National Parks and Public Land Legacy Restoration Fund, to pay for deferred maintenance on public lands. During the pandemic, Americans sought to get away from the confines of quarantine to enjoy the great outdoors. Trails became littered with trash and human feces as maintenance of restrooms proved difficult with reduced staff. This in turn endangered water and habitat and provided a pathway of contagion for both human visitors and wildlife. Meanwhile, the national parks have faced climate change-induced Climate change induced forest fires on a scale not seen before. Western drought is now being recognized as a more permanent form of aridification. Add to this a summer of wildfires raging across the West, hurricanes and flooding battering coastal regions, the loss of habitat, destruction of infrastructure, fallout in rivers, streams, and lakes, the growth of toxic algae and toxic air, making trail maintenance more difficult. What pathways could a native director of the National Park Service possibly take out of this mess? According to writer and historian Wallace Stegner, national parks were the, quote, the best idea we ever had, absolutely American. He also called the establishment of the parks, quote, absolutely democratic. Never mind tribes there that lived there had no say. Quote, they reflect us at our best rather than our worst, Stegner declared, in spite of the fact that the establishment of national parks was only made possible by the violent removal of indigenous nations from the land in question. The us Stegner is referencing is the white America that invaded native lands. With this history in mind, in a recent piece in The Atlantic, Ojibwe writer and historian David Troyer called Yellowstone, quote, a crime scene. In an interview on PBS NewsHour, he called for the park's return to the Shoshone, Bannock, and other tribes. And not just Yellowstone. Troyer is calling for the return of more than 60 national parks, from the Grand Canyon to Joshua Tree, over 80 million acres all told. Despite claiming on PBS NewsHour not to have plans, just ideas, he lays out a compelling argument for national parks to be turned over to a consortium of tribes. Troyer recounts in his article how just 5 years after Yellowstone, the first national park, was established by President Ulysses S. Grant in 1872, it was where Chief Joseph's people, the Nez Perce, also known as Mimi-Pu, were infamously hunted down by the U.S. Army, even as white American tourists enjoyed the views. This summer, Glenn Nelson, a writer and wildlife photographer, documented his recent trip following the Nez Perce Trail. The trail is a series of national monuments and parks that commemorate the path Chief Joseph's people took as they attempted to seek safety in Canada from American aggression. The monument at Battle of Canyon Creek Historical Site, part of Nez Perce National Historical Park, he notes, has seen better days. Here, Chief Looking Glass's snipers held off the 7th Cavalry so the Nez Perce tribe non-combatants could put some distance on the U.S. Army. It may be that Americans will never have to come face-to-face with the loathsome idea that their invasion of the New World was never a monument of moral courage at all, wrote Dakota writer and professor Elizabeth Cook-Lynn in her essay, Why I Can't Read Wallace Stegner. Rather, it was a pseudo-religious and corrupt socioeconomic movement for the possession of resources. It may be that the Plains Indians are not done, as assumed in Stegner's fiction, rather they continue to multiply and prosper. Can Native leadership save our indigenous homelands? Or is this once again the case of the glass cliff, a term describing how, in a moment of crisis, a woman or person of color is brought in to lead and take the blame if they fail? There are examples of Native-run parks. The Navajo Nation, of which I am a citizen, runs 6 tribal parks, including the world-famous Monument Valley Tribal Park and Lake Powell National Navajo Tribal Park, without direct federal subsidy. In 2018, pre-pandemic, the largest Navajo Nation park, Monument Valley, attracted about 400,000 visitors per year and brought in over $4 million in revenue from entrance fees, tours, and filming permits. In 2018, the Navajo Nation finally signed a co-management agreement with the National Park Service for Canyon de Chelly, the only national monument on tribal land established 86 years prior. Canyon de Chelly was where Navajo people sought refuge from the U.S. Army and still farm inside the canyon to this day. The Navajo Nation's approach of creating tribally run national parks out of trust lands is very different from David Troyer's proposal of turning an entire federal agency over to tribal management. Certainly, such an action would require some congressional action. It would require all the Democrats to support such an action, and that seems unlikely. Senator Kristen Sinema, Democrat Arizona, won her seat on the strength of the Native vote in Arizona, but she has not proven to be a great friend to tribes. The return of the Sacred Blue Lake to Taos Pueblo in 1970 through the bipartisan passage of Public Law 91-550, signed by President Nixon, is a product of a very different congressional era. It was much smaller in scale than the entire National Park Service, and the strict land use requirements dictated to the tribe by Congress infringed on the sovereignty of the Native Nation. What Congress has been able to do, however, is pass a massive bipartisan uranium handout that forked over $75 million to Energy Fuels, a Canadian uranium company. See my article in High Country News, Trump's Message for Tribes, Let Them Eat Yellow Cake. Even the process of tribes petitioning the federal government to put land in the trust can be a prolonged and expensive one, as noted by Secretary Holland. In April, she issued Secretary's Order 3400, which reversed Trump-era orders that served to complicate and delay the land in the trust process. If tribes were to apply for national park lands to be put into trust and Holland approved these, tribes could emerge from the Biden years with a lot more to say over their traditional homeland. This is especially significant as efforts at creating co-management compacts have been very slow, and the NPS itself has failed to meet stated goals towards diversity and inclusion in hiring. Such resolute actions would not only incur pushback from right-wing and anti-public lands activists, Republican leadership, and local white rural residents, but also state governments. Chuck Sams has experience with yet another approach to tribal management of former homelands. From 2006 to 2010, he worked with the Trust for Public Lands, TPL, as National Director of the Tribal and Native Lands Program. The TPL works with tribes to help them acquire and negotiate lost homeland and put land into a different form of trust, a public land trust, which can often be done more expeditiously than the tribal land in the trust process. However, in 1997, The TPL assisted the Nez Perce tribe to obtain 10,300 acres in the Lualaba Valley in Northeast Oregon. During his tenure at TPL, Sams worked with over 70 tribes and Native communities and helped develop strategies to reclaim Native lands to restore watersheds and waterways, quote, wildlife corridors and forests. He also worked with the Yakima Nation to obtain a 35-acre peninsula called Lyle Point at the confluence of the Kukutat and Columbia Rivers, called Nanaimiwaki'ukut, or place where the wind blows from two directions. It was a fishing site and village for thousands of years and lost to the Yakima people in the 19th century with the arrival of rapacious white settlers. Traders in the 1800s brought blankets that were contaminated with a smallpox virus. Johnny Jackson, chief of the Cascade Band of the Yakima Nation, is quoted recalling on the TPL website, "It wiped out the whole settlement. When I looked into the buffalo's eyes that day near Old Faithful, I did not think of my ancestors. These expansive connections to land are difficult to comprehend living as we do in our reduced circumstances on reservations. The ongoing U.S. occupation of our homelands makes our world smaller. It restricts how we imagine what we once were and what we could be. As we drove through Yellowstone, my middle school-aged daughter pointed out places she recognized from playing the video game Wolf Quest when she was younger. She had spent years role-playing being a member of a gray wolf pack, racing pups and surviving on the digitally recreated landscape. In the 21st century, displaced and removed from our homeland, this is how Shunka Ishnala's 5-times-great-granddaughter now knows the place where he was born. How we heal from this history is in our hands today, now today. Are we willing to take steps to do so, even if it outrages the part of America represented by the Republican Party? For the first time, Native Americans like Secretary Holland now hold key positions in power over large swathes of territory in the United States. The potential leadership of tribal leaders like Chuck Sams, whose training is tribally management focused, may offer a glimmer of what a new inclusive future for America could look like. Could it save the world from climate change? Could it save us from the political, rural, urban divide we see today? Could it make us one people, genuinely tied to the land and not colonial systems of exploitation? We will only know if we try. We only may get this chance. That was the article I wrote about almost exactly a year ago. It was published in Sierra Magazine. And yeah, I'd love to hear what you all think about it. So I often go way over the word count that editors give me, but Everett's a great editor there at that magazine. He's very generous. I think that as a Native woman, when I approach these issues, like, what does it mean to have Chuck Sams, a Umatilla tribal member, head the National Park Service? It does leave my mind in all kinds of directions, you know, and I hope that I hope that people who read the article, that they also begin to see new opportunities as well for how to address these issues, these sort of intractable issues. I should note that Chuck Sam's nomination was not uncontroversial. Obviously, the Republicans opposed it. Even people who were from within the National Park Service were upset that he was coming from outside of the National Park Service. But as I noted, after 30 years of diversity initiatives, the National Park Service had not made a lot of progress and in actually hiring people of color. And so there really is not a generation of leadership within the National Park Service of Black, Indigenous people of color to actually step forward and make that to lead. So it definitely had to come from outside of that system. And Chuck Sams is obviously from outside of that system. And I think he's been doing a great job. I haven't heard anything negative about his leadership there. If you'd like to call in and let me know what you think about this topic and, you know, your own experiences with national parks and how you think they should be, what we should do to preserve them and perhaps to make right past wrongs, you can call the studio at 503-231-8187. And my name is Jasmine Keeler, and this is American Standoff. And today we're talking about national parks, Yellowstone in particular. This show is in honor of Indigenous Peoples Day. I guess we're going to call it Indigenous Peoples Week. I was still in Yellowstone on Tuesday. I spent my if you look on my Instagram at JF Keeler, you'll see I posted videos at the park, and it was just, you know, I mean, on a way, some people might dismiss going to Yellowstone or going to sort of a version of Disneyland or something, but you know, as we were approaching it, it still overwhelms you, and it's still, and I like to see it as more than like, as I played that audio at the beginning, a sort of patronizing tone of like, where wild animals still roam. You know, I was, you know, even hiking there, you have to think differently. Here you take a hike and, you know, say in Washington Park, and you don't really think anything of it, but maybe people fear mountain lions or something. But there, you know, this is their home, and you have to make a lot of noise so that the bears and the wolves know you're coming. You know, you have to be respectful. I did see some tourists taking chances with the buffalo, and I think we've all seen the YouTube videos of or the TikToks of people being depantsed and even gored by their horns. You know, I have to say that I'm amazed my ancestors used to hunt them. you know, going up close and seeing them and knowing, having full respect for them, it's an incredible experience, you know. And so once again, this is Jacqueline Keeler, and this is American Standoff, and you can call in. The number is 503-231-8187. And so I thought I would also play a little audio about, to kind of break it up, about some of the history of Native people at Yellowstone.
Julie Francis, archaeologist with the Wyoming Department of Transportation. Yellowstone and its geology played a very important role in the spiritual and religious beliefs of a lot of people. The Yellowstone Plateau is perched across the Continental Divide, and it straddles what early anthropologists defined as three major culture areas. These include the Columbia Plateau, the Great Plains, and the Great Basin. Many tribes believe that supernatural beings resided in some places within the park.
Well, we do currently have 26 tribes that are formally associated with Yellowstone, and for a lot of them, they have absolutely spiritual connections to thermal areas and elsewhere throughout the park as well.
The geysers and the mud volcanoes were seen as portals to the supernatural world and were used by many different groups for fasting and for vision questing. The Crow used the park area extensively and considered it part of their homeland. They used the area for hunting. They used it for gathering plants, as well as various minerals that might have been used in pigments and paints. They still retain place names for locations within the park. The Kiowa, who now reside in Oklahoma, part of their origin myth is that their people were essentially created and born somewhere in the mountains immediately to the north of Yellowstone. Thus, Yellowstone National Park and that surrounding area figures very prominently in their cultural identity. The Nez Perce used to hunt buffalo on the east side of the Bitterroot Mountains in Montana, and were very familiar with this area even before the 1877 Nez Perce War. The Bannocks also hunted in this area. The Blackfeet also traveled through the park on many of their raids throughout western Wyoming and this area. The Salish-speaking Flathead and Pendarai also came into this area for hunting and other uses. The Eastern Shoshone, what we now also think of as the Wind River Shoshone, considered this part of their aboriginal land claims. They led military expeditions through the park on well-worn and used Indian trails and had intimate knowledge of the geography and resources of the region. The Shoshone consisted of autonomous bands, politically autonomous bands, that were often named by the principal food resource. So hence in the mountains here, with the abundant evidence of sheep trapping, we have the sheep eaters. Over in the Idaho area, we have salmon eaters using the vast salmon resources of the snake. There were the root diggers, as well as the buffalo eaters, who were more adapted to a plains lifeway. The only permanent residents that we can identify are the mountain Shoshone, or also known as the sheep eaters. In fact, the sheep eaters were extremely sophisticated hunters of mountain sheep, highly skilled flint knappers. Ancestors of the Shoshone, including the sheep eaters, created some of the most complex rock art that we know, not only in this region, but in the world. It's known as the Dinwiddie tradition, and it's found in areas surrounding Yellowstone Park.
So that's some history there of a sort of brief overview of some of the tribal relationships to Yellowstone. And one of the tribes that has an official relationship with the park is my dad's tribe, the Yankton Sioux tribe as well, and the Rosebud Sioux tribe in South Dakota. And so the next article I'm going to read was published in Condé Nast Traveler, and it was published on March 1st, 2022, and I guess the editor from Condé Nast read my Sierra Magazine article and wanted something sort of similar. This is the 150th anniversary of Yellowstone National Park, and while I was there, I made sure to get my t-shirt and hat that says 150th anniversary, just because, you know, and I was there, and I wrote two articles about the park, and so this year, and in the past year. So the article is titled, What the Land of Yellowstone National Park Can Teach Us. Indigenous people have called this place home for millennia, and as the planet warms, clues to its long history are being revealed. And so this was published on March 1st, 2022 in Condé Nast Traveler. So I'm going to start reading it. And if you want to call in while I'm reading and you have things you want to share, please do. That's fun. So, in 1870, an expedition led by Montana politician Henry D. Washburn bore witness to the tremendous power of Yellowstone's geysers. The trip had been difficult, and yet even in their damp and disheveled state, Washburn and his group of travelers were overcome with wonder. So much so that Washburn gave Old Faithful its name that very day. Just 2 years later, President Ulysses S. Grant signed the Yellowstone National Park Protection Act into law. With a stroke of a pen, the first U.S. national park was born. And I think it's also the first park in the entire national park in the world as well, I should add. Native people are continually forced to explain the need to preserve sacred lands. Take the fight over the recently restored Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, or the Dakota Access Pipeline near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in north of South Dakota.
that the members of the 1870 expedition who had seen the terrain, though indifferent to the people who already inhabited it, understood its power. They saw that its value had nothing to do with mining, ranching, logging, or even property ownership and turning virgin land to the plow. This was not the first reserve to exist in the United States. There was Yosemite, which the state of California had already established as a park, and the hot springs in Arkansas that owing to their therapeutic properties had been set aside by an act of Congress. But the formal establishment of Yellowstone represented the first time the country had sought to safeguard an area simply out of respect for the land itself. Yet this respect for the land did not extend to acknowledging the humanity and value of the indigenous people who had called it home for millennia. Consider the forced removal of the Mountain Shoshone people from Yellowstone after it became a national park, to the Fort Hall Reservation in Idaho and the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. After some 11,000 years, they were driven from their homeland to make room for pleasure seekers. As Lieutenant Gustavus C. Doan, a member of Washburn's expedition, proudly wrote about the trip, calling himself, quote, the man who invented Wonderland, he took credit for, quote, the discovery and development of pleasure and instruction for the human race. His name has yet to be stripped from the park's most famous peak. I think that happened recently, actually. It says, due to Doan's desire to turn it into a tourist destination, what exists today is only a glimpse of what once existed in Yellowstone. There are more than 1,850 identified archaeological sites across the park, less than 3% of Yellowstone inventoried. However, as the planet warms, clues to that history are being revealed. In 2010, a researcher found a 10,300-year-old Aflatl dart recovered from an ice patch near the park, the oldest found anywhere in the world. What could we have learned from the Mountain Shoshone? Another clue to the park's history lies in specimens of mineralized lodgepole pine, which collected by scientists as part of the Greater Yellowstone Climate Assessment last summer. Radiocarbon dating of the samples pins them to between the early 13th and mid-14th centuries, extraordinary in itself. And there was another reason the finding made headlines. For trees to grow in its geyser mound, Old Faithful would have had to cease erupting for several decades, likely due to severe drought. It's a breadcrumb that cannot be ignored. Since 1950, temperatures in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem have increased by 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit, an average annual snowfall has decreased by nearly 2 feet, a matter of grave concern. Snowpack is a savings account for water. It melts and provides needed resources for plants and animals in the spring. The area is also home to the headwaters of major tributaries to some of the largest rivers in the West, the Columbia, the Missouri, and the Colorado. Higher temperatures could severely impact the availability of water downriver, which would in turn affect farmland and urban centers. The climate assessment found that average temperatures around the past 2 decades have been higher than any period in the last 20,000 years, meaning the annual temperature is projected to increase by 5 degrees Fahrenheit between 2061 and 2080. If it does, Old Faithful may stop spouting once again. Yellowstone is home to 10,000 thermal features, not just geysers, but hot springs, mud pots, and fumaroles, a landscape so dramatic that it led the early explorers who stumbled upon it to vividly compare it to hell. As we approach the 150th anniversary of the park's creation, the beauty of these thermal features is exactly what draws so many people to the park. True hell would be failing to protect these unearthly wonders for generations to come. So that's the second article I wrote about Yellowstone. And yeah, it was really fascinating to research all of these things because, as a writer, you do go down these incredible rabbit holes, and of course, none of it appears in the article. And of course, exploring sort of the geology of Yellowstone was fascinating, and then the history of the different expedition teams that went out there, and reading, I even read their original diaries just because I don't know, and actually, when the editors, when they fact checked, send this off to the fact checker, you have to prove every single piece, everything, every quote you put in there, that you have to be able to prove that it actually is real. And so I had to go through those original diaries and say, here's where they said that, and so So it's that could going through the fact checkers can take it be a long process itself. And this is why when I got the announcement that I was the finalist for the High Plains Award, I really wanted to go there, and I wanted to go to Yellowstone in particular, because I was approaching it from a different perspective this time, because I was this is where that relationship to the land, right? I have both a scientific appreciation, a geophysical appreciation for the science, the earth science behind what's happening there, but also just my own ancestral relationship to the place itself, and so I wanted to walk those trails again, and just view them differently and feel that presence. And I think the land can heal you. Being out there was incredibly healing. We stayed at an Airbnb cabin near the eastern entrance, the north and northeast entrance. They're still closed after the flooding that happened in June, and won't be reopened until October 15th. And so we stayed there, and place. I can see why my ancestors wanted to come there, to roam there and to be born there, even, when I was on a panel in Billings for the awards, someone asked me if I knew, because I mentioned that my ancestor had been born there over 220 years ago, and they wanted to know if I knew exactly where. I don't know. Was it near this one lake or something? And I'm like, I don't know. I probably need to talk to my Bordeaux relatives on the Rosebud Sioux Reservation. They might know more. And I think it was fascinating. I know 20 years seems like a very attenuated connection, but of course that connection was only cut because of the coming of the Americans, right? The inability to move around the land and to know the land. And that relationship to land, I think, is what, I've said this before on the show, it makes us a people, right? It's the very relationship to the land that makes us who we are as a people. And when that is cut off, then we are not, we lose something. I've also mentioned on the show how I was traveling to Mankato, Minnesota from Minneapolis one time a few years back. And I want, that's Mankato is a site where was the largest mass hanging in U.S. history. They hung, 38 Dakota men plus two later. The Dakota had risen up against the white settlers because the treaties were not being honored and their children were starving to death. And this was called the Dakota Indian Wars, right? And so later they went and basically captured a bunch of Dakota men and charged as a crime and then hung them all at one time. They built this mass hanging place, and there's like you can look up pictures of it. They issued plates with engravings of all the men lined up ready to be hung, and so I wanted to go there and see that place. And my family have stories about the Dakota uprising as well. Many of the Santee came to our reservation to seek refuge, and we took them in. And because we're there, they're our relatives, they're our family. And so I went there, and as I was driving down from Minneapolis, I stopped at a museum that was on the side of the road right before I got to Mankato. And in the museum, there was a map showing all the Yankton villages that had been in the little creek beds and stuff around where the museum was. And I was completely shocked. I didn't know the Yanktons lived around Mankato. I didn't know. And then they had paintings, watercolors, actually, that were done in the 1830s by a European man. And they showed Yankton women doing maple sugaring. And I can tell you that no one on the Yankton Sioux Reservation maple sugaring. And it's something that we've completely forgotten about ourselves, and it's the relationship to the land that makes us who we are, right? Our reservation is now on the farther western side of our original range, and it's just a small part of that. And so, I just wanted to share that experience with you. It was beautiful to be on the land, and to be informed by the land. You know, and I was really glad I went when we did because there was hardly any. We weren't overwhelmed with other tourists there. I do want to eventually walk the Chief Joseph Trail. I mentioned the guy, his blog, where he took photos of it. And it was, what photo was, let me see here. It was sad because the Chief Joseph Trail, what he found in the, when he documented his blog was that it was not being maintained very well. And I actually maybe I should ask Chuck Sams or the National Park Service if that's changed, you know, if they are maintaining that trail now. And I think most of us are familiar with the story of Chief Joseph and his band fleeing the U.S. Army and trying to make it to Canada, leaving behind their beloved Wallawa Valley in Oregon. And so they recently I mentioned this on the show before, they recently got some of their land back through the sort of land trust model. I don't know why the land was taken from them. I don't think that many people live in Wallawa County in Oregon. It's been amazing going out there. Another issue is that, you know, I probably need to follow up and find out the blog is called Glenn Nelson. If you're listening with his blog, I put a link, Trail Posse. You can follow him on Twitter, Trail Posse. And he has a whole bunch of photos on there. It's called trailposse.com, or AILPOSSE. And you can look at his photos of the Nez Perce Trail there. I am wondering if Secretary Holland, how she is using her power, because she can put land in a trust, which then takes it out of the state jurisdiction, has a lot of ramifications that way, and makes it part of their tribe's reservation, basically. And she can do that without anyone else, without consulting anyone else. She, as the Secretary of the Interior, has that authority. So I'm going to have to check on that and see how she's using that authority, whether she's putting much land in a trust, if that's improving the ability of tribes to have say over their homelands. Because our reservations only account for a small part of our traditional land base. And so a lot of sacred sites are not located on reservation land. The tribes have no jurisdiction. It's very hard for them to have a say about what happens to those sacred places. I mean, right now with the book I'm working on about the Manhattan Project, Mount Taylor in New Mexico, that's where my grandmother's grandfather's family were living at Mount Taylor when the Americans came and they murdered his parents, my grandmother and my great-great-grandmother and grandfather. The story is his name was Big Horse the Warrior. He was a warrior under Chief Manuelito fighting the Americans. And as a 16-year-old, he went out hunting and he came home. And he came back to the Hogan. He found that the American army had murdered his parents. His mother was at her forge. She was a silver maker. So she was at her forge, and they killed her at her forge. She was slumped over on it. And then they killed his father, who was a Navajo trader. He was Navajo, but he went around the Navajo lands and traded, you know, like, with, I don't know, like tin pots and stuff like that, you know, how traders did in the West, but he did it for the Navajo community, and he himself was Navajo, and so they had killed him. He was making a bridal, but there at the Mount Taylor, which is the sacred mountain for the Diné people, one of the four sacred mountains. This is the southern sacred mountain, and in between the sacred mountains is our sacred homeland, the Diné Ta or the Diné Pekea, and so they have dug. You know, as part of the Manhattan, part of the development of nuclear power, they dug one of the largest uranium mines there, and and you know that and didn't at all consult with the tribes that hold that mountain sacred, and now we have to live with that for thousands of years. So you know, when I write about these issues, it's such a multi-pronged thing. I mean, it's I could write I have to write so many words every day just to cover a tiny, tiny part of it, you know, and it's still not enough, you know, it's not enough. And but I hope these words I share today that I've written in the past year just about Yellowstone and what national parks mean versus, you know, what our native you know, sort of connections to the land, how what those mean and why those have value to all of us, to even to the world itself. You know, to the survival of human beings, those kinds of connections based on respect, on a peoplehood not based in profit or extraction, is really important. We need to change our model because the model we're using now is destroying the world. I mean, the world will survive in some form, obviously, but will we be a part of it? That's the question. You know, So I know, you know, with the threat of nuclear war again, which is strangely, you know, is what I'm writing about right now with my book. The name of the book I'm working on is called Song of the Sun, Letters to Oppenheimer from the Fourth World. And it's a series of essays I'm writing directed at Robert Oppenheimer from a Native perspective. And but hopefully this show helped a bit. It wasn't as dark and dreary as most of my episodes are, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for listening. This has been American Standoff. I'm Jacqueline Keeler, and Hagoshi.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 10:59 a.m.
Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.